I think we should get started since all of you are here and other people can just drift in. We're going to have a few preliminaries before we get to the panel. So, first of all, I'm Leslie Carruthers. I'm the head of the Environmental Law Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this get-together. I'm not going to be introducing the panel. That will be done by Jamie, who is the head of the... Here comes one more. Who is the chair... who is the chair of the ADA's Constitutional Law Committee, which is part of the section on environment, energy, and resources, and we're delighted to be partnering with holding this program, Jamie. So thank you for your partnership and for being our moderator on this important program. ELI is particularly interested in the standing issue. We're interested in climate, too, but we're particularly interested in standing because we regard citizen participation as one of the main pillars of the strength of environmental law. And as many of you know, we have a program called Endangered Environmental Laws, which deals with a number of the issues that we think are important in terms of having a strong environmental program and framework, and that have been increasingly challenged in litigation. So we're very interested in the standing issue and concerned about efforts to limit the access of citizens or organizations to the courts to advocate environmental claims. In my own history as a both public and private sector person, I've been sued in both capacities. I actually lost some of the cases. And so my views on this are not affected by the fact that that it has not always been helpful to me and my clients that citizens were able to have access. I believe in it, and ELI believes in it, and that's why we're interested in this case, both from a policy standpoint and just in terms of the fascinating intellectual issues that it presents. So I'm going to ask Lisa Goldman, one of our attorneys who works on the Endangered Laws Program, to make just a few comments about some of the work we're doing in that area. Then she will introduce Jamie Colburn, who will in turn introduce our distinguished panel to talk specifically about the recent case that was argued before the Supreme Court. So, Lisa?
Thanks, Leslie. 2 weeks ago, the oral argument before the Supreme Court in Massachusetts v. EPA brought to the forefront an issue that may transcend the important question of whether EPA has authority to regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act. That issue is the scope of a plaintiff's constitutional standing to bring a climate change lawsuit in federal court. With the court having spent more than half of the 60-minute argument questioning counsel on standing, its ruling next year in Mass v. EPA could easily become the next big case in the evolution of standing law. Because much of the discussion surrounding Mass v. EPA has centered on the climate change debate, we thought it was crucial to assemble a panel of experts who could speak to what this case might mean for the law of standing as it has evolved under Article 3 of the Constitution. Notably, each side in the Massachusetts case has argued that its view of standing is consistent with existing law and that it is the other side's view that would represent a radical departure from current notions of injury, causation, and redressability. At oral argument, the justices posed extensive questions about each of these aspects of the standing doctrine. We trust that our panelists will sort it all out for us today and that by 2 p.m. we will know for sure whether Massachusetts does indeed have legal standing to protect Cape Cod from rising waters. We are very pleased to host today's seminar in partnership with the American Bar Association Section on Environment, Energy, and Resources. Moderating our discussion today will be Jamie Colburn, Chair of the Section's Constitutional Law Committee and Assistant Professor at the Western New England College School of Law. I'd like to thank all of our panelists for being here today and the audience for joining us, and I'll now turn it over to Professor Colburn to introduce today's speakers.
Well, thanks, Lisa, and thanks to Leslie Carruthers, Bruce Myers, and Lisa for really being the laboring oars in this partnership. It's actually been a partnership in name only. Lisa especially put this together, so I'd like to first thank Lisa for putting all the hard work into actually having this panel. It's a pleasure to introduce this panel. This is a panel that's fit for the issues raised by Mass versus EPA and standing more generally. To my far left is Bill Busby, who's a professor at Emory, where he founded and now supervises their Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic. Bill teaches in the areas of environmental and natural resources law and land use, and he's published widely on these issues in the, I had to write this down, Michigan, Stanford, Cornell, Penn, Iowa, Fordham, and other law reviews. We drew straws, and Bill is going to provide the five-minute, Bill drew the short straw, the five-minute description of standing doctrine prior to coming to his remarks as the opening speaker. To Bill's right is Scott Nelson, who is a graduate of Harvard Law School, where he was elected president of the Harvard Law Review in 1983. Scott started his career as an attorney at Miller, Cassidy, LaRocca, and Lewin, and he was there until 2000 when he joined the Public Citizen Litigation Group. Scott is very experienced in standing issues, often litigating cases against the government for purposes of disclosure of information. And his appellate experience is also broad, spanning things as diverse as death penalty cases, complex white-collar crime cases, banking and insurance matters. And finally, right to my immediate left here is Jeff Clark, who returns to Kirkland & Ellis after a time at the Justice Department as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General for their Environment and Natural Resources Division. Jeff is also a skilled litigant when it comes to standing issues. He actually litigated the Mass versus EPA case before the D.C. Circuit, and most recently appeared on a panel discussion of these issues before the Federalist Society last month, at their annual attorneys conference. So without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Bill for our brief introduction. Our hope is to have about 10 minutes per panelist discuss, and then with the balance of the time, do a little bit of exchange among the panelists and hopefully also open it up more broadly for questions and discussion later.
Thank you. Well, thanks, Jamie, and thanks, Lisa Goldman, especially for pulling this all together, and thanks to ELI for sponsoring this occasion. But I'll just say, I think I'm supposed to do 5 minutes of the prelim and then my 10 minutes, but I just, otherwise, I'll just speak so fast no one will understand anything I'm saying.
We're very jealous about our time.
Yeah, okay. So, well, I guess I'll start off by saying that the Massachusetts case is a really remarkable case. And on the standing front, for those of you who followed the briefing, but especially the argument, it really did present in very stark terms the power of standing to possibly knock people out of court and possibly a politicized court to do so, but really just the power of standing to release the executive branch possibly from court supervision. As you all probably know, but perhaps don't, the Supreme Court has been quite divided on standing since 1993 when they decided the case called Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife. There have been a string of cases back and forth leading one professor to say this body of law is all politics, no law. But actually the last two cases prior to Massachusetts versus EPA, the court seemed to settle into a certain analytical mode that I would call a kind of statute-dominated view of standing, but the Massachusetts versus EPA case revealed that this is still very much contested terrain. So my task is twofold. I'm going to start by giving just as much as I can to just very neutral sort of Hornbook law discussion of standing law, and then I'll shift gears and talk about what was interesting in Massachusetts versus EPA and offer my both editorial comment and reading of the tea leaves about where this will probably come out. Well, first, standing's origins. It is all rooted, at least in the court's language, in the constitutional language about cases or controversies. Standing doctrine, called standing doctrine, is actually quite a modern creature from the mid-20th century. And if you actually look at the number of standing cases where it's been a contested issue, they actually overwhelmingly picked up in pace in the mid-70s. And then really became active in starting with Lujan versus National Wildlife Federation, which I think was 1991. Now this is not to say, although this is an area that Judge Wald years ago said, you know, standing law is undoubtedly an area of judge-made law. There certainly is truth to that in the sense this has been developed by the courts. On the other hand, I think most people, including people who have strong kind of editorial feelings about it, would agree that part of what's happened is the increasing public law and the increasing enlistment of citizens in regulatory regimes has kind of tested the limits of what the Constitution allows, and hence you have a body of law that is dealing with what the court's role is and the legislative role and the role especially of citizens and states in litigating under federal law. The first cases, if you actually look at standing doctrine slightly before it was called that, the first cases were this question about whether people had an adequate controversy were cases where people sought on constitutional grounds to knock out a case where there was no cause of action. And so the first lawyers who, kind of like Jeff's role, argued for the federal government trying to knock out standing was in a very different position, where they were seeking to uphold federal legislation against what was usually a constitutional attack. More recently, standing doctrine has been kind of used in a different way to deny people access to the courts where they may be seeking to enforce federal law. Interestingly, if you actually look at the cases starting in the 70s and a little before it about standing doctrine, a lot of the cases started off really just fleshing out the meaning of the Administrative Procedure Act. And so it was looking at the language about adversely affected or aggrieved under the APA. Then the Supreme Court started just using that language, not necessarily anchoring it to the APA, and then took that language and really in the second Lujan case, Defenders of Wildlife, that language was explicitly said to be rooted in the Constitution. And it is now clearly an area of Article 3, not just an area of legislative fiat. I should also add that the early cases prior to Defenders of Wildlife seemed to say that you had to be adversely affected or aggrieved unless Congress had conferred a cause of action. And one of the big innovations, starting with the Lujan Defenders of Wildlife case, is that that was a case where there was an explicit conferral of a cause of action, and yet the Supreme Court, a majority of the Supreme Court, found there not to be standing. And hence, as the current Chief Justice said in an article shortly after Lujan, which he argued, he said, yes, this may be the first case in which this has happened. I think he was correct. I think it is the first case. Now, there is kind of one settled core of standing, despite the fact this is a somewhat innovative body of law that's built up over the last 30 or so years. It is really quite settled law now, and I would say it's 9 justices agreeing on this one point. It is not enough just to have a cause of action at this point. 9 justices agree, and this has been the law since Sierra Club versus Morton, that a plaintiff arguing before the court has to be in some sense among the injured, in some sense set apart from the general public and not just presenting a generalized grievance. And so whatever the roots are, that is a really unanimous view of the court now, as far as I can tell, in recent decisions and arguments and questions. Now let me go into the basics of the modern framework. Basics of the modern framework were probably set out with greatest clarity in Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife. This is an opinion by Justice Scalia for the court, but had a handful of opinions, including a very interesting and important concurrence by Justice Kennedy. But the basic law here is that there must be an injury in fact that has to be concrete and particularized, actual and imminent, not conjectural, not hypothetical. And second, the injury has to be traceable to the challenged action of the defendant, and it must be redressable by the courts. And it cannot be, as part of that, it must be likely, or as opposed to merely speculative, that it will be redressed by a favorable decision. Another aspect of the court's decision-making that's been interesting here is, although this is clearly a contested terrain, especially in the area of environmental law, at least in the court's language, since Sierra Club versus Morton, the court has repeatedly affirmed that it is not just economic sorts of interests that are protected, but that aesthetic, conservational, and recreational interests can suffice to lead to standing. I say it appears to. It's been in language, but if you look at the scholarship and commentary, I think it's correct that there's some question whether that is really as fully believed now by all of the court. In Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife, some of the dissenters really questioned if the court was acting consistent with that declaration in Sierra Club versus Morton. The real divide on the court, in my opinion, and this is not editorial comment, but I think if you actually just parse the opinions, is the following. You have at least solid under the Rehnquist Court, at least a solid four-justice block that looked at standing through a kind of common law perspective. Justice Scalia was clearly the most ardent advocate of this. And in this view, if you look at his language, which sometimes has garnered a majority, he really looks for common law-like sorts of injuries, tort injuries, monetary injuries, threats to real property. On the other side, and what you all clearly do have, four justices that remain the same, you have justices who say that it is not enough just to have a cause of action, but if you look at their analysis, it is always shaped by the interests and injuries made relevant under a statute. And in that block, you have Souter, Stevens, Ginsburg, and Breyer. What you have in the middle, as seems to be the case in almost all areas, is Justice Kennedy, who from Lujan to the present has been very often kind of this swing vote. And even in Lujan, his concurrence, as I'll talk about in a second, was critical. We have justices, Chief Justice Roberts, now Alito, on the bench. While we don't know for sure whether they will come out on this, Chief Justice Roberts did argue the Lujan Defenders of Wildlife case below. He also published an article about it, and based on his questions, that he appears to very much be in the Scalia camp. I would be shocked if he deviated from that. Justice Alito is slightly to the right of Justice Scalia on this. As far as I can tell, that based on his lower court opinions, especially joining an opinion called Magnesium Electron, I think that he would probably be even more stringent in denying the courthouse doors to certain kinds of public citizen plaintiffs. Not literally public citizen, public sorts
but very
of
very likely.
Yes, yeah, he might agree with that, but they're not literally public citizen plaintiffs. So my sense is still Justice Kennedy is the key sort of swing vote. To kind of explain this key division on the court between the kind of common law-dominated perspective on standing and the more statute-dominated focus, it's important to look at language by Justice Kennedy in his Lujan concurrence. This is joined by Justice Souter. And this really, I think, looking at the cases since, has been the dividing point. And this is what he said. He said, Justice Scalia kept on talking about looking for these common law sorts of injuries. And then in this ostensible concurrence, Justice Kennedy said something like, language he said, nothing in the court's opinion suggests a contrary view. But this is what he actually said. He said, as government programs and policies become more complex and far-reaching, we must be sensitive to the articulation of new rights of action that do not have clear analogs in our common law tradition. In my view, Congress has the power to define injuries and articulate chains of causation that will give rise to a case or controversy where none existed before. And in the subsequent cases, I think this really has been the point that has made the difference. There's this traceability prong. It's pretty much what it sounds like. You have to trace the injury to the person you are suing. On redressability, you've had a vacillating Supreme Court, this third prong. The Lujan case, there was no majority on the question of redress. You then had a case called Steel Company, which had an unusual posture of a violation that was remedied post-notice, pre-complaint, and the court found there not to be a redressable injury because penalties went to the government, and there was no reason for specific relief given the fact that the problem had been remedied. Most important case in redressability prior to Massachusetts versus EPA is not an environmental case, but the case called Aikens, in my opinion. And that was a case involving the FEC and a question about whether a particular political committee had to disclose information. And so it was a statute requiring the revelation of information. And the question was, well, if they're going to sue, we don't know if the information will come out. We don't know what the FEC will do if they do it right. And an opinion by Justice Breyer, I think this is a 6-3 split on the court, he said, the fact that that we don't know what the agency will do on remand does not destroy redressability, even though there is retained prosecutorial discretion. Agencies always have, I'm shortening a little bit, often have discretion about whether or not to take an action. Yet people have standing to complain that the agency based its decision upon improper legal grounds. And one interesting question I'll explore more, and I hope we'll explore as a panel, is why isn't this case very much a kind of very core Aiken sort of case where the claim is EPA relied on inappropriate factors? The most recent case prior to Massachusetts versus EPA was a classic Clean Water Act citizen suit, the case of Friends of Earth versus Laidlaw. And in that case, in a decision that I think Justice Scalia was right, was in tension with the Steel Company case, the Supreme Court, in a 7-2 opinion, found that there was standing. And again, in its analysis, as in Aikens, in explaining why there was standing, kind of back and forth, explained why there was standing, making very close reference to what the statute created, what the injuries were under the statute, what the interests were, and explicitly said in Laidlaw, 7-2 majority said, standing hurdles should not be raised higher than is required to win on the merits under an underlying statute. And so it's another kind of interesting issue that we see in Massachusetts versus EPA. So adding it up before I turn to my editorial comments, you have in this seesaw of opinions, Lujan, standing denied, mostly on injury and fact grounds, Bennett versus Speer, another case, standing was granted to commercial interests. Steel Company, no standing due to lack of redress, and also language about penalties being inadequate. Aikens, a non-environmental case, strongly granting standing, emphasizing statutory frameworks, and then Laidlaw also granting standing and emphasizing statutory frameworks and again. So now I'm going to shift gears to my, I hope that's a fair statement. I think that's, there was a recent case the Supreme Court decided, I should say, just this past term involving taxpayer standing, and it could come into this. I'm not going to discuss it, except I think it's consistent with old taxpayer standing cases, which is it is hard to bring a case if you're a taxpayer unhappy with how your money is going to be spent. But I think Justice Roberts will probably bring that case and that body of law into his opinion in Massachusetts. Okay, shifting gears. So, as I said, the rhetorical and analytical dividing lines on the court in standing, I think, really have to do with this question of, is this all kind of a common law sort of did I stub my toe sort of analysis of standing where a court has to agree someone's really been hurt, or the more statute-dominated approach to standing where, as Kennedy says in his concurrence in Lujan, where Congress can identify injuries and articulate chains of causation and causes of action where none existed at the common law. And this is the split. I think this has been the split. If you look at the argument in Massachusetts versus EPA, if you look at the briefing in the case, and I suspect in the briefing below when Jeff worked on it, I think that this is the split, and the question was how do you reach the swing votes who in the old day, Rehnquist went back and forth, but now clearly it is Kennedy. I don't think we know for sure where Roberts will come out, but I can't help but think that this is just another case where it's going to all hinge on Kennedy, but I don't know how others feel about that. Massachusetts versus EPA and the parties' arguments. I guess there's one interesting aspect. This was that about half the plaintiffs, half the petitioners were states. Justice Kennedy noted in the discussion, drawing in a case from the turn of the century, Georgia versus Tennessee, or Tennessee Copper, I forgot.
Tennessee Copper.
He noted that in that case, the Supreme Court contrasted a state's ability to bring a suit from an ordinary citizen's ability to bring suit for pollution. And Justice Kennedy raised this in the argument, saying, doesn't this make a difference where Massachusetts, and I would say also aligned states, were bringing suits? We don't know what's going to happen with that. The way he brought it up, I think that's going to matter to him, and it is an old historical case that did talk about state special ability. If you go back, that's from this line of case about state's ability to act in parens patriae, acting on behalf, protecting the resources and citizens of a state. A second interesting question is, this really does look in many respects like a standard administrative law challenge, alleging, inappropriate statutory interpretation by EPA. And yet in the argument and the questions, there was very little focus on Aikens. And frankly, the questions really didn't seem to focus on that. I'm not clear why not. I mean, it was in the petitioner's briefs, but still in the argument, it seemed to kind of move away from that. Really where I think this case is going to turn is there is a whole way the court dealt with, and especially Alito, Chief Justice Roberts, Scalia, and I assume Justice Thomas, but he didn't ask any questions, is how uncertainty plays into the picture. And I think this is going to be a key aspect of this decision. Previous cases, Lujan to the present, when people talk about problems of uncertainty, they often dealt with a problem called chains of causation, where someone is either claiming that you need to get a chain of people to cause an injury or a chain of people to act in concert to remedy it. But it usually has been literally that. The phrase is a chain, and it usually has been sequential necessary actions. The facts here are kind of different. I mean, this is dealing with one agency, one industry target, cars, one pollutant, carbon dioxide, and cumulative harms that are caused by multiple sources simultaneously. So this is quite distinct from the chain of causation setting that the court has looked at before. In the questions of the what I call the Scalia block, they didn't seem to see that as a distinct factor or a distinct setting. I think it is. Whether they will see that, I'm not sure. Now, there were a whole bunch of new possible standing prongs we can look for, so I'm going to rattle them off, and then I'll turn to the others. There did seem to be an argument, an inchoate argument being made by the justices. Again, this question is from Justice Scalia and Roberts, mainly what I call the multiple causation problem. If cars are among many sources of pollution, and is there enough of a substantial cause Some of the briefs talk about this idea of a materiality requirement. The Solicitor General's office did argue it in those terms. You know, there's kind of insufficiently material, substantial part. But this is a multiple causation problem. It's just they seem to say if lots of people are causing a problem, maybe that's enough to deny standing. Closely related was what I would call the small percentage and temporal distance problem. A lot of questions said, this is only 6% of the world's carbon dioxide. I would think that's a lot, but putting that aside, they said only 6% of the world's carbon dioxide comes from U.S. cars. But then arguments were, okay, but even if EPA regulates, it will over time reduce pollution, and that will take several years. And so in the end, the concession was probably you're dealing with 2.5% reduction in a handful of years of the globe's carbon dioxide and its greenhouse gas effects. And so this seemed to be something that the court was concerned about. Justice Scalia started off by saying, when is the predicted cataclysm? And so he really was looking for the predicted cataclysm when, in fact, this case is about what is a huge, vast, I think it's 100 billion or something, tons of carbon dioxide that are at stake. But clearly this small percentage problem was at stake. There's also what I call the confounding factor aspect. Several questions of the justice were like, yeah, but if we act, what's to say other countries are going to act? What's to say other industries will or will not improve? Might this all just be futile? And so this is what I call the confounding factor problem. The argument of the Massachusetts lawyer from the Attorney General's office, Milkey, for Massachusetts, that is, he said, you have to look at the Clean Air Act, which talks about trying to prevent harms and trying to deal with sources that contribute. It doesn't have to be a sole cause, just they contribute. There was also an aspect of this case of unusual saying scientific uncertainty. There were a few questions that seemed to say, well, if the science is sufficiently uncertain, maybe that would give grounds to knock out standing. Those were more elliptical points. But tying to that, an interesting issue that didn't go anywhere, at least the justices didn't focus on it, was petitioners in this case presented a raft of affidavits talking about global warming and the science and where it stood and the effects and the harms. And Justice Scalia has been particularly strong in recent years in saying, standing is to be proven. This is not something to be done in speculative modes, either defeating or granting standing. And for reasons that I'm not clear on, there were no controverting affidavits presented at all. So you actually have uncontroverted factual evidence before the court, and neither the federal government nor the people put in contrary affidavits. And the question here is the court, can the court really reach contrary scientific conclusions when there's nothing whatsoever on the record here? And that's an interesting question. And again, before Lujan to the present, how standing was to be argued was kind of in flux, but this issue of the uncontroverted affidavits is major. The other justices, Breyer, Souter, and the rest, really seemed to be sympathetic to the idea that relief would be telling EPA to do its part in remedying this portion of the pollution pie. Last point I just make, in the arguments about this, and I saw that I think Jeff Clark made a similar point at a recent talk, I wasn't clear if it was the ABA or Federal Society, something I found on the web maybe through your bio. People sometimes say, standing doctrine is the way the courts keep politics out of the court. And the argument there, of course, is that politics should sort out the priorities. Okay, so the argument there is that the court should stay out of it and let politics sort out kind of what matters are dealt with and what aren't. The contrary view, which I think is often omitted from this sort of rhetorical ploy, is that what the plaintiffs sought to do in this case, and our petitioners sought to do in this case and in many others, is to seek to enlist the courts to enforce what the political process has done, which is to pass laws that require certain actions with certain criteria. So as was said in several of the dissents where standing was denied, standing is clearly a separation of powers area. It clearly is highly political, but a denial of standing means the executive branch has kind of unchecked latitude to possibly ignore what politics has already done. So I'll stop there and have for comments and questions.
Well, we can either continue on with our presentations, and that would put Scott on deck, or we can give the other panelists a chance to question Bill, or we can put those questions off until after the initial presentations.
Why don't I just go ahead with some sort of short remarks, some of which are actually picking up or responding to some things that Bill said, and some of which are just reflective of a couple of my own thoughts of what's significant here. And I want to start with one of Bill's last points, not because I think it's the most important point here, but just because I don't want to forget about it. The question of the evidentiary basis of the standing determination and the existence in the record of affidavits, I think one thing that may be of interest here is that I believe in this case is an artifact of some procedural standards that have been developed by the D.C. Circuit that are really unique to that circuit that require petitioners really in almost any administrative challenge, unless you're a directly regulated industry and you're challenging a regulation that says you can't do X, in which case the court will consider your standing to be self-evident, you're required now by the D.C. Circuit case law, a case called Sierra Club v. EPA, I believe, and now by the D.C. Circuit rules, to put in affidavits demonstrating your standing. And the typical practice that has developed in the D.C. Circuit is petitioners put in those affidavits, and the government, which is typically the respondent, and whatever interveners are supporting it, attack the sufficiency of those affidavits, but generally don't put in their own contesting affidavits, but instead, to the extent that there are factual matters that they may intend to rely on, they tend to look at things that are in the administrative record. And the reason that the petitioners often are not able to rely on the administrative record is that the administrative record, as a general matter, may not happen to develop facts that go only to the question of whether a particular petitioner will have standing later in court to challenge the agency action. So that's, and I'm not sure, other than those Supreme Court members who recently sat on the D.C. Circuit, which would be Roberts, I think, is the only one who's been there since Sierra Club, they may not be fully aware of the reason why D.C. Circuit procedure has contributed to there being this sort of one-sided record on the issue. It does make for a kind of unusual situation where in some ways it appears that there are uncontested affidavits, and it may be obscure to the Supreme Court exactly why that is. Beyond that kind of procedural wrinkle, I wanted to principally focus on two aspects of what the Supreme Court addressed in the arguments, one of which is imminence and the other of which is redressability, and some of their impact both within environmental cases and more broadly in administrative law cases generally. Imminence is in some ways kind of a curious feature of the standing doctrine, in part because it overlaps with another justiciability doctrine, ripeness, and its ripeness going to whether the issue is currently suitable for judicial review, and the imminence factor, in other words, how far are we along the road toward the situation where this issue is really going to concretely affect people, is considered to be an important factor of ripeness. The question is, what is it also doing in standing, and what does it mean there? Justice Scalia, I think in particular, asked some questions of counsel for Massachusetts that sort of focus on, well, how soon is this going to happen? 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, as if to say that imminence has some kind of a temporal cutoff, and if it's just counting some number of years too far down the line, you're not going to recognize standing. The question that comes to my mind is why that is. I think in part it is because the court chose a word to capture a concept that may not be entirely suitable. I think what the court was trying to do when it announced imminence as part of the standing requirement is is not to impose sort of a rigid, at least originally, kind of timetable, but rather to say, you know, have we gotten to the point where we really need to resolve this issue? But we may get to that point in some cases if something is happening now that is going to have an effect with a high degree of certainty 50 years from now. If it can't be fixed later, now would seem to be the time to fix it. And imminence, though, by suggesting that even if now is the proper time and the action that will cause the injury is going to be fixed now and couldn't be fixed later, we're still not going to address it because it's too far down the road. I think, you know, it would be a damaging development for the court to go to that notion of imminence, and it's really difficult to see why that serves any of the purposes of the standing doctrine, which, after all, is intended to ensure concrete adversity and a real controversy, and a certainly impending injury that will occur 15 years from now, if now is the time when it could be redressed and it could not be redressed later, as the plaintiffs or the petitioners argue here with respect to warming, is as likely to create a concrete case or controversy as an injury that will occur tomorrow or one that occurred yesterday. And interestingly, the D.C. Circuit, at a time when Judge Roberts was still on it, I believe, a couple of years back decided a case involving a challenge to the Yucca Mountain, EPA's Yucca Mountain groundwater regulations, where they found that an injury was sufficiently imminent to confer standing that they determined would actually occur several hundred years in the future when contaminated groundwater that EPA's regulations permitted to occur at the site would cross the boundary of the site and begin affecting adjacent property. I think that's probably the high water point in terms of imminence in any case that I've seen. But, you know, the Supreme Court's concept, or at least Justice Scalia's concept of imminence here as involving a cutoff that it has to be soon, regardless of how certain it may be, would have a pretty significant effect in cases like that, and possibly in many others where an administrative action fixes a regime in which consequences will follow, but the timing of the consequences is may not be entirely predictable, and some of them will occur in the future. You know, that's a pretty common situation, and at least in the D.C. Circuit, imminence has generally not been, in those kinds of administrative law cases, understood to mean that it has to happen tomorrow or this year or next year. And if the Supreme Court were to go with imminence in this case, you know, that I think would have a significant effect. Redressability, though, I think is where most of the discussion in the Massachusetts case seemed to be headed, although causation and redressability are very closely linked in the case because, you know, much of the court's question about redressability was linked to its questions about whether the agency action that was being challenged here is a cause of enough of the claimed injury so that changing the agency action would have the effect of redressing that injury. I think in thinking about redressability here, I wouldn't say that the questions from the justices who are skeptical about redressability in this case reflected a sea change from prior cases, but I do think that Bill really sort of put his finger on upon the difference between this case and prior cases where redressability has stood as an obstacle. Those have mostly been cases where the court thought that changing the action that was being challenged wouldn't really have any substantial effect of redressing the claimed injury because the claimed injury was really in its entirety attributable to other independent decisions. Here, the argument seems to have morphed into, well, this is a large problem that has multiple causes, and addressing one of those causes might reduce the problem to some degree, but won't eliminate it altogether. And that is, I think, a really novel concept of redressability. Unless the redress that you could obtain from challenging the agency action is you know just de minimis, the courts have generally, I think, not suggested that that redressability will be an obstacle. And in fact, you know, the courts in Lujan and subsequently in a case called Norton v. Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance have stressed that a plaintiff can't come in and challenge broad programs that address comprehensively, you know, entire issues. They have to focus on particular agency actions that focus on discrete aspects of a problem in order to even get in the door. But if you now say, well, but I'm sorry, if you come in and identify a particular action that has caused you a little bit of an injury in the context of a much broader environmental challenge, you know, redressing that injury won't solve enough of the problem to give you standing. You've really put plaintiffs in environmental cases in a real bind. And this, by the way, redressability is not by any means a problem that's confined to environmental cases. It's one of the government's favorite arguments these days, I think, particularly when you challenge a government action that authorizes private entities to do something, permits private entities to do something, or fails to prevent private entities from doing something. One of the moves the government typically makes is to say, well, if you change our policy or our regulation, it still won't necessarily prevent private entities from doing this, and therefore, even though we're permitting them to do it, authorizing them to do it, they may be doing it anyway. Or if the government prohibits someone from doing something and you want that person to be allowed to do it, the government's argument is, well, once we stop prohibiting them, they still might just not choose to do it. That argument was recently made in an interesting case the D.C. Circuit just came down with a couple of weeks ago called Abigail Alliance versus FDA, which is a case brought by a group that is challenging FDA regulations that make it difficult for persons with untreatable terminal diseases to have access to unapproved experimental drugs. And these plaintiffs actually allege that they have a substantive due process right to have access to these drugs, which is not a claim that I personally or my group endorses, but it's certainly the case that FDA regulations inhibit their access to these drugs. And the D.C. Circuit actually, a few months ago, ruled in a 2-1 decision that there was a substantive due process right. The government petitioned for rehearing and rehearing en banc, raising, among other arguments, a standing argument, and the standing argument being premised on redressability and on the concept that, well, if the FDA allows pharmaceutical companies to make these drugs available, that still doesn't necessarily mean that the pharmaceutical companies are going to make them available. And therefore, you haven't established that by overturning this policy, you're going to solve the problem that gives rise to the alleged injury. It was interesting what the D.C. Circuit has done in response to the rehearing petition is on the merits of the substantive due process issue, they unanimously have granted rehearing en banc. But on the standing issue, the original panel actually issued a separate opinion denying rehearing on standing, in which even the dissenting judge, Judge Griffith, who had rejected the substantive due process argument, joined. And basically what they said was, to kind of cut things short, get real, this FDA policy is preventing these people from getting access to these drugs, and if it's overturned, there is a realistic or a significant likelihood that they will get some kind of relief. It will be more likely that they will be able to, at least some of them will be able to get access to some of these drugs. Not everybody may get them. People may still die, but, you don't have to show that the redress that you're going to achieve is going to completely eliminate the problem. If it eliminates a significant barrier that stands in the way of the relief that you ultimately want and that may lessen the injury that you claim, that's enough. And in Massachusetts, if the premise is that dealing with 6% of the problem isn't enough because, Massachusetts may still lose a significant part of its coastline because of the 94% that won't be dealt with by the regulations that Massachusetts is seeking to ultimately compel the government to put in place. That is something that in a lot of cases the government, I think, will use to choke off access to the courts, because it's extremely rare that you can come in and say that the relief you seek will with certainty eliminate a problem or do more than just alleviate it to some degree. And one thing that I also think is kind of interesting in light of the discussion of statutory rights and whether the creation of statutory rights is sufficient to permit standing. Remember that Massachusetts' principal claimed injury is actually not an injury to a statutory right, but to a very traditional property right. Their contention here is that they're going to lose property that they own on their coast. And so that, even on the Scalia view, if you can come in and show that you have injury to real property that you own, that's usually sufficient to permit standing. And the question is, well, if we can't prevent you from losing your property completely, but we can make it less likely that you'll lose all of it, that's not enough. I think that even on the very traditional notion of what kinds of injuries count, that will be a significant cutback in the ability to obtain relief. And with that, I'll yield to the other side.
Okay. Well. Thanks. And looking at the time, I think, particularly if my perspective had equal time, I'd probably eat up all the time. So I'll try not to do that. So you have some time for questions. What I'm going to call my remarks, I've given it a little title, is that standing isn't a game. Increasingly, I see articles, arguments, short articles, presentations that really seem to me to come at things from a perspective that standing is sort of kind of like a set of boxing rules, and they have to be equal, and they have to apply equally to environmental plaintiffs and other kinds of plaintiffs. And I reject that perspective. Standing isn't a rule of evidence that's to be applied equally to the sides. It's not a rule of procedure that's to be applied equally to the sides. Instead, it's a vital constitutional doctrine that protects the separation of powers. And that means sometimes, maybe unfortunately for the sort of designated perspective of ELI, that environmental plaintiffs and other plaintiffs seeking programmatic improvements in the courts as opposed to in the halls of Congress can't get access to the courts because that's not the nature of the judicial function. The separation of powers is important to me, and I think, you know, the cases are replete with discussions of how standing serves that function. But I also think that it's important to understand that part of the separation of powers is understanding the definition of each of the three powers. And to my mind, and I think the cases bear this out, the core of the judicial function is a kind of classical notion of A versus B litigation. You know, Marbury versus Madison, Smith versus Jones, cases that could be heard historically at Westminster, which some of the standing cases have talked about in the past. That's what the judicial function is about. It's not about some sort of sweeping improvement, again, programmatic change outside the halls of Congress. And that's why, at least to my mind, and to what Professor Busby calls sort of the common law perspective, you know, the case names even can be grating, sort of, you know, concerned citizens with a collection of generalized grievances, to throw in my own perspective, you know, for the southern part of the mountain versus Jones. So many environmental cases are like this, but they embody essentially the nature of the problem, which is not to say that any particular case like that has a standing difficulty, but that it shows sort of how far in some instances we've strayed from the classical A versus B litigation that the core judicial function is about. What the fact that separation of powers doctrine is embodied and that standing is a part of means is that it can have asymmetrical effects on different kinds of plaintiffs. That doesn't mean that that standing doctrine is being politicized. It doesn't mean that standing doctrine is being gerrymandered by the individual justices who uphold a common law view. It seems to me that whatever you want to say about Justice Scalia, he really believes in this perspective. I think it's something to be commended, and I think that he's one of the least result-oriented justices that you can find. To my perspective, that is a very important point to keep in mind. You can talk, it seems to me, all you want about creating new freedoms, about, you know, even new property and the like, to take some people back to law school in the due process area. But that's not really the system of government that the framers have designed. They've designed a system of government that's primarily about liberty in the sense of freedom from government action and government coercion, and not the freedom to have some form of government intervention. So what that means is that built into the very nature and structure of the Constitution is essentially an important distinction or discrimination between those that are being subjected or on the receiving end of some form of government action, whose liberties are being restricted, and those who are essentially calling for someone else to be regulated. And the standing cases bear this out. It's much harder to demonstrate standing if you come in and you say, those guys over there, please regulate them, government, as opposed to saying, I'm being regulated, I'm being hurt, please stop your unlawful, unconstitutional, or otherwise illegal government action. And the Massachusetts versus EPA case is a case that falls into this category of please regulate the other guy. Please, there's a rulemaking petition filed by a group called the International Center for Technology Assessment, which is how the case got kicked off. And they ask for the EPA to regulate the automobile industry. That's the nature of the case, and it's important to keep that in mind. The reason why the standing rules operate differently in that kind of situation is that, you know, for folks I typically represent in private practice, it's not hard to demonstrate standing. They're on the receiving end of government action. They're being told they have to stop doing things they used to be doing. They're being told to do new things that will be costly to them. They're being restricted or they're being commanded clearly in one form or another. It's obvious that they're standing there, and that's why the D.C. Circuit procedural rule that Scott referred to creates this distinction essentially in the Sierra Club case, and the D.C. Circuit created it before the rule, between those who have self-evident standing and those whose standing is not self-evident. Something I also want you to understand about the Massachusetts versus EPA case, particularly in light of Bill's discussion of what I'll call the kind of statutorification of standing law in the minds of some justices, is that this suit in Massachusetts versus EPA is not a citizen suit. It's not a suit that's proceeding under Section 304 of the Act. Rather, it's a suit that proceeds exclusively under the APA. The group I mentioned, the International Center for Technology Assessment, they filed a petition with EPA to regulate. The only thing that gave them the right to file that petition and ask for a response was a provision in the APA that allows anyone to petition for a new rulemaking. EPA answered that petition and ultimately denied it. There's a long line of D.C. Circuit cases, and actually for the life of me, I still can't understand why it wasn't easily invoked in this case by the D.C. Circuit to affirm the government. It's a case line of cases I call the American Horse Protection Association cases. Those cases build on Heckler versus Cheney, and Heckler versus Cheney held that essentially, unless government the Congress clearly states otherwise, the prosecutorial discretion as administered by the executive branch is beyond the reach of judicial review. And building on that principle, in the American Horse Protection line of cases, what the D.C. Circuit has said is that there has to be an extremely light touch on the standard of review that's applied to reviewing agency action and determinations on rulemaking petitions. And think about it. It's even more Heckler versus Cheney than Heckler versus Cheney. This isn't applying existing law and using that discretion as to whether to apply it or not. This is the very discretion as to whether to create new law that applies to multiplicities of parties. Surely that authority, which it seems to me is even more far-reaching and more a discretion that should be protected, that's the reason for the light standard of review, which the D.C. Circuit has said is akin to non-reviewability in the American Horse Protection Association line of cases. That's the procedural posture in which this case arises. And I actually would have thought that there would have been more talk at the Supreme Court level about that, because there are no Supreme Court cases that have sort of faced that particular question, even though it's a well-developed body of law in the D.C. Circuit. Let me explain why it is important that this isn't a citizen suit case in terms of what I think was, Jimmy, I think you sent it sort of a piece about what the environmental strategy was in this case. There's a case, actually the number of cases in different courts of appeals, but one significant one that involved the lead NAAQS, the lead National Ambient Air Quality Standard, where the EPA essentially had made all the findings that related to the public health being endangered by the relevant lead pollutants, but then sort of simply declined to take the next step and regulate. Based on the way the statute was written, that made them amenable essentially to suit to say once they'd made that finding and crossed that Rubicon, as it were, they were subject to being sued to actually issue the relevant National Ambient Air Quality Standards. Here, particularly because there's no citizen suit provision, and also because of the way the statute was written, which is Section 202 of the Clean Air Act, there is no way essentially to pick off the endangerment finding. The agency hasn't independently made the endangerment finding. The agency has only essentially faced this petition. There's no procedural right that the parties have essentially to force a determination on the endangerment finding. That would be akin to sort of forcing partial summary judgment. And there's no right to that built within the statute. The answer that the Deputy Solicitor General gave on questions that went to that wasn't very crisp, but it's a vital point, and it's a point that in the D.C. Circuit argument, Judge Tatel, who was inclined against the government, really latched onto and actually attempted to get me to concede. He kept coming at it from different angles to try to get me to say that once an endangerment finding was made, then it would be mandatory to issue regulations. And what I said was, no, Your Honor, unfortunately, under Section 553E of the Administrative Procedure Act, they can only ask for the binary determination of whether there's a regulation or not. And that's subject to your light standard of review. And as long as the agency hasn't clearly considered something that shouldn't be considered, that's an exercise of discretion that should be upheld. Now, The two-step strategy also, it seems to me, relates to something fairly cynical that you should also be aware of, cynical in my view anyway, in terms of the history of this case. Back in the Clinton administration, Congress asked the Clinton administration for its view of whether there was authority to regulate greenhouse gases. That caused a general counsel opinion to be issued by Jonathan Cannon. Jonathan Cannon said, yes, there is authority. But then at the very end of his memo, he says, but we're not going to exercise it. Then, lo and behold, a petition is filed seeking judicial review on the issue of, seeking to have the agency issue a rulemaking. That petition is sat on for a number of years. The petition was actually filed. It's the petition in this case in 1999. And then it's put over for the new administration to deal with. To my mind, since the Clinton administration had been clearly on record with Kyoto in wanting to push the issue of global warming policy, why didn't they go ahead and grant the petition? Why did they stop? And it goes to actually one of the core functions that the separation of powers serves and the standing doctrine serves, which is a notion of accountability. If you ignore the fact that the Take Care Clause grants to the president the authority to ensure that Congress's laws be executed, standing is really the handmaiden of the Take Care Clause, then you have a situation where the courts essentially become the enforcers of the law or the arbiters of whether to enforce the law based on whatever private parties might bring to them to ask them to enforce. And that makes it very difficult for the public to know who's accountable for things that happen. So, instead of granting the petition and then, the public essentially knowing, maybe who's going to be responsible for the next recession or the next several recessions, the previous administration says that they're not going to exercise their discretion. They leave the petition sitting around. And then what that sets up essentially is an APA-type citizen suit. And if that were successful, then who's responsible for that? Is it the court? Is it the group that moved for it? It's that kind of diffusion of accountability and confusion in the public's mind as to accountability. Standing doctrine eliminates those confusions. Standing doctrine makes it clear that if this is, I think, one of the beauties of the way our republic is designed, if you feel strongly about global warming policy, if you disagree with the Bush administration's global warming policy, then, as they say, vote the bums out of office. It seems to me that there's not an option, essentially, to try to rope in and to ignore the restrictions on the judicial branch to circumvent that. It doesn't result, it seems to me, really in either good policy or good law at the end of the day. Let's see. Then some observations about what my fellow panelists have said before I turn it over for Jamie to have questions. I think that the Aikens case, which was mentioned, is readily distinguishable. But the first thing I'll say is I think that there are some connections between the case. And interestingly enough, I think Justice Breyer, who wrote the majority opinion, never really answered the key objection that Justice Scalia had in dissent, which is that the information there, which went to whether a particular Israel-related interest group needed to disclose information about its members that could be used for voting purposes, was that the government didn't have the relevant information. What the action sought to compel was for the government to go out and collect the information and then turn it over. And what Justice Scalia pointed out, again, and you can read the decision, I don't see any response by Justice Breyer to this point, is that that was equivalent to compelling the executive branch to use its enforcement discretion. It wasn't just asking for, as previous cases had done, for information to be revealed. That being said, I think that the right to vote, an informational standing case on for information to be revealed. That being said, I think that the right to vote and informational standing cases that relate to the right to vote are very different than a case like Mass versus EPA, which is a case where essentially if there's injury, it has to be injury in the nature of this environmental fact will cause harm that actually redounds to me. It's not an informational sort of case where, even Justice Scalia, in one of his standing decisions, has essentially admitted that the relevant standards need to be lighter. So that also indicates that there's not quite the dichotomy in terms of, common law injuries versus statutory-based injuries. I think even Justice Scalia, and this is why it seems to me the Kennedy concurrence is not so far out of line and was denominated a concurrence, is that Justice Scalia would grant that, yes, Congress can recognize new injuries. Congress can grant, by that mechanism, some form of standing. But there are constitutional bounds on doing that. He thought they were exceeded in Aikens, and I might tend to agree. But even if one counts Aikens as solid, settled law, I think it's an informational standing case about voting is very different than the situation faced in Mass versus EPA. The Laidlaw case, I think, is a case that is also very different in that you clearly had sort of folks who were complaining about a river being polluted, and there were people who were among the parties claiming standing who said that they went and visited the river. I think majority of the court saw that as an easy case for environmental standing. I think the global warming dispute is very different than that. I could comment on a number of the other points that have arisen about, scientific uncertainty and the like, but let me focus on the main thing I'd like to address and before I close, which is that the real problem with standing here in the Massachusetts versus EPA case is the redressability issue. And the redressability issue really comes down only to one affidavit by Professor Dr. McCracken. And McCracken essentially alleges that if this petition is granted, and then if EPA regulates, which is, understand first, that's a further if, right? The petition being, so there's that causal chain. But then McCracken says if that happens, then virtually, at least a significant number of other nations in the world will adopt something like the United States regulations, and that will cause the problem of global warming to be averted at least to some degree. That's clear speculation based on the actions of third parties. And here, that's not just a theoretical concern, but it's a concern of great practical moment because it's entirely speculative, and exactly the opposite may happen, as Justice Alito focused on in oral argument, because once the United States or even other European nations were to regulate to reduce carbon emissions, other nations, China and India are the ones people think of most readily, have an incentive essentially to free ride on those efforts. They could free ride on those efforts and actually cause emissions to increase. And that free rider problem, which the Solicitor General stressed in his brief, that's the real practical reason. And those countries didn't sign Kyoto, so this is not a theoretical concern. That free rider problem is what eviscerates standing and what makes standing speculative. And it seems to me that, regardless of Dr. McCracken's certainty about what's going to happen in the actions of various nations as a collective whole, it seems to me that's not enough to maintain a case for standing. So with that, I will stop.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Thank you, panelists. I wanted to put it open to questions just to make sure that we have enough time for questions from the audience. So I'm ready to recognize people. Please specify who your question is for or if it's for the whole panel.
Can I make two quick comments?
Please.
This is Leslie Carruthers. Much as I hate to date myself, I just have to concur in what Jeff has said about the original lead case about requiring EPA to set an ambient air quality standard. I defended that case for EPA. And in fact, the difficulty I had is I informed my client, EPA preferred as a strategy matter to regulate lead additives and gas and smelters, which were the overwhelming sources. We did not want to set an ambient air quality standard. But as I explained to my clients at the time, we have got this problem in that we've made almost all the findings that would support an ambient standard in the context of regulating lead and gasoline. So I lost, notwithstanding my best efforts. But the other point I would make also relates to lead, and it came up tangentially in one of your comments, and that is the uncertainty factor about the climate issue. I was interested because I also wrote the brief in the lead and gasoline case for the in-bank case in the early 70s and argued part of it. And Chief Justice Roberts asked in terms of uncertainty, well, how would you compare this to lead? I mean, climate change and lead. And, everybody now thinks that lead is a total no-brainer, forgetting, of course, that we lost the case in the D.C. Circuit 2-1 because the court said, unless you can show us exactly how much of this lead is coming from automobiles as opposed to paint or food, you lose. I mean, there was that uncertainty factor and a host of others. So I think he probably thought the comparison was a lot clearer than in fact it was 30 years ago in terms of scientific uncertainty as it relates to the definition of harm. So in, you know, to me, having been there at the time, the uncertainty factors were not all that different between the two cases in response to Justice Roberts' questions, Chief Justice Roberts' questions. So I just thought I would add that bit of history to the mix here.
Lovely. Can I regard that as a comment and not a question?
Yes, you can. Okay. I meant it as a comment.
Okay. Fair enough. Any questions from the audience? Like I said, I want to make sure that there is time for questions from the audience. Please.
It's Deb Kendall from Community Rights Council. I actually addressed the first part of the question to Jeff and then the second to Bill and Scott. On your free rider problem, I guess my response to that is it seems even more speculative to say that China and India are going to respond by increasing their emissions than McCracken saying that they're going to respond by decreasing their emissions by following our lead. And the Massachusetts theory here, at least as articulated oral argument, is we don't care about speculation either way. We think the 2.5% here is reasonably likely to cause an effect. Isn't that enough for redressability? So that's part one. The problem with that, and I'll address the second part to Bill and Scott, is that there is some uncertainty in the science, as I understand it, about precisely how that 2.5% may affect. There's kind of two theories. One is I call the blanket theory, which is 2.5% increase in emissions reduces the effect by approximately or some amount like that. The alternative theory, which is getting some play in science, is the triggering point, which is basically maybe it actually has a huge effect, but you know, we don't know which 2.5% it's going to be. And that strikes me, and kind of Kennedy was kind of getting at the triggering point hypothetical when he says, well, you know, isn't a small risk of a really big problem enough? And then Souter was kind of getting at the blanket theory when he's saying, well, it seems reasonably likely that this is going to have some effect. Isn't that enough? I guess the question on that part is, how do you write up a standing opinion in face of that, the genuine aspect of scientific disagreement?
Okay. My response to that is that, you know, I haven't worked through the numbers, but you're right. You've heard 6%. Now you've gone to 2.5. It's, you know, in terms of my understanding is the motor vehicle fleet as a whole, you know, as currently constituted, it's 2.5. But now,
no,
understand
6%, and they say it's reasonable
benefit
to get a 2.5% reduction out of that 6%.
Well,
after 10 years or so.
Okay, here are the factors. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but here are the factors you need to consider. For number one, you're only talking about new motor vehicle emissions, which doesn't relate to the entirety of the fleet. So whatever number it is, it overstates.
But
it's turnover, and it increases the span of time, and it decreases the effectiveness of any you know, supposed remedial action. The second thing is that the remedial action isn't going to abolish the entire automobile fleet, even as it exists, or even new automobiles. It's only going to regulate it and reduce it to some extent, which is going to similarly shrink the number. My understanding, and this is my firm recollection from having read all the affidavits, is that things really do depend on the McCracken affidavit indicating that whatever you could get from cars, it would be insufficient to cause a really measurable effect by any individual who was before the court. You need to have some cooperative action by other governments. Otherwise, there's also no reason then to present the affidavit.
That's not what the McCracken Declaration says. I mean, his assertion is that emissions reduction in this case will be enough. Now, there's some detail later on where he kind of explains that, and there's some question about whether the summary is supported by the actual body of that declaration, but he says flat out that this reduction's cause in this case will cause this problem.
But I read it, and the Solicitor General, the Solicitor General's office agreed to be a linchpin, that it depends on this other action. It's not just a notion of, you know, he said two things. One is, This action independently will solve the will redress the problem to some degree, and also you get some extra benefit if there's sort of international cooperation. My view is that that international cooperation will emerge. I didn't read it that way, and again, you know, the Solicitor General's office, which has particular duties of candor in these matters, didn't read it that way either.
I guess I would respond to your question about the scientific uncertainty. I think the only way, I think one is reading the tea leaves, looking at the justices' questions. I think, you know, I think Kennedy is a little harder to read, but I think the others, they really are saying, you know, this is, what is EPA's part, what is this industry's part under the law, and so they're really looking what the Clean Air Act does, which talks about pollutions that contribute. I mean, if standing doctrine starts looking everywhere for proof that a particular targeted source of pollution has to be the one that completely eliminates a harm, well, then throw out all the environmental laws, throw out health regulation, throw out workplace regulation. There's almost no, throw out bankruptcy. I guess commercial lawyers are privileged, but the under the this view. But the I think the in so many areas of the law, you know, law is incremental. It is targeted. There are weird political coalitions. Complete cure of any harm is virtually non-existent in the law. So I find that to be a in some sense, Doug, I guess my sense is that the only way to answer it is to think about what the statute says. And the statute talks about, you know, contribution. You look at CERCLA and how it works. I mean, the environmental laws, and I would say workplace and risk regulation, even some pharmaceutical regulation, is dealing with what are often incremental contributions to certain risks and harms. And I think that's the only way to make sense of it. If the court completely rejects that and adopts the, you know, the free rider view, when there are kind of confounding factors that could kind of undo what might be the required efforts under our law, then that does become a very broad, you know, a broad power of standing to knock people out of the courts just to even get rid of those incremental improvements.
Yeah, if I could just say a couple of things. First, to kind of go back to the first part of the question, I would actually, I'm not an expert on what any of these affidavits say. I would think it would be problematic to have a case where standing depended on actions of other people who were not subject to the regulation that was at issue, and where, you know, the redressability just depended on the notion that if we set a good example, right, others would follow. I read the oral argument transcripts in the same way the questioner did, to suggest that Massachusetts' theory was that leaving those things entirely to one side, the specific incremental change that they were seeking would have some tangible effect. And I hope that's the argument, because that's the only argument that I think has a chance of actually prevailing in this setting. The question is then, you know, how do you deal with uncertainty? One problem that this creates is, you know, there are some cases that suggest that, you know, to get into court in classic district court litigation, you have to allege standing. You don't have to have proved it in your complaint. But then as the case progresses through summary judgment and trial, you know, if you can't establish at that point by a preponderance of the evidence that you're going to obtain relief, you know, the court in theory should at the end of the day rule against you, and it almost becomes a case where the standing and the merits probably merge. If you haven't established that what you're seeking is going to do you any good, you're not going to lose. But that model doesn't work very well when what you're dealing with is administrative review in a court of appeals on an agency record, and where, you know, the only evidence that comes in specifically on standing is the affidavit that you've attached to the, you know, to your brief in the D.C. Circuit. You know, if the court actually has to resolve as a factual matter, you know, what impact a 2.5% reduction is going to have on global warming in order to decide the standing question, that's a prescription for absolute futility. And so, you know, I think that where the court is ultimately going to go, and I would expect everybody to agree on this, is that, you know, you're not going to have to prove, even by a preponderance, that you're necessarily going to achieve a particular level of redress. But I think, you know, the court is going to have to look at what you've alleged and think, you know, is it realistically likely? And my guess is there are going to be justices on this court who think that 2.5% doesn't seem realistically likely to do you any good, and other justices who will think, gosh, you know, 2.5%'s got to do some good, and then what Justice Kennedy thinks may tip the balance on that issue. You know, it's not necessarily, though, the most analytically satisfactory way to answer the question, but I think it's the only way that the court's going to be able to address it.
I just want to throw in one small point, which is that it seems to me, in response to Professor Busby, that you know, and I worked a lot on the American Trucking case and remember the record on ozone and PM there. I mean, that, you know, when you're dealing with so-called non-threshold pollutants, you have a very different situation than you have in this case, where you have not a localized pollution problem where essentially there's a poison in the air that's harming people, but rather something that by an indirect causal chain, and you know, there was discussion about where this occurs at the oral argument in the atmosphere. I don't think it's particularly material, which is why I agree with Justice Scalia's joke. If there's an indirect causal chain, it occurs you know, in the upper atmosphere, and then it sort of redounds to have potentially global effects. It's a very different problem. It needs to be analyzed in a different way, and it can't be analogized to the traditional problems of the NAAQS regulation. And so for that reason, precisely if it goes off on those unique kinds of facts, wouldn't threaten at all those kinds of, you know, past holdings in environmental cases or cases beyond that, where, you know, there is mention in the setup for the talk of, you know, civil rights actions and the like. I mean, if you're being discriminated against, it doesn't seem to me that a case that goes off on the unique facts of global warming and the fact that it is a global problem and not a localized problem would have any impact on such cases whatsoever.
Tim Dowland from Community Rights Council. We filed an amicus brief on behalf of National League of Cities and the counties and other organizations. My question is for Jeff Clark. You talked about how important it is for standing documents to promote separation of powers. And I agree with you. We don't want people whose grievances are at their core, legislative or regulatory, to take those grievances to the court. But I think in the course of making that argument, you ignored what Professor Busby said about this particular case, which is what Massachusetts wants and what the petitioners want in this case. It's just a straight-up reading of federal law. They're not asking the court to regulate. They're not asking the court to engage in policy matters. They just want EPA to comply with the law. And it seems to me that if what we're concerned here is separation of powers, that, well, why in the world would we want a standing doctrine that's going to keep that argument being made by people who have alleged actual ongoing injury from being able to take that to the court? Or to put it another way, suppose they were to follow your advice. Suppose Massachusetts went to Congress tomorrow and ultimately got a law that said EPA must regulate carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, period, answering the merits questions before the Supreme Court. As I understand your theory, they still wouldn't have standing. If EPA were to say, we're not going to implement this, Massachusetts still would not have standing to complain about EPA's violation of the rule of law because of redressability. Well, why does that make any sense at all?
I think that on that question, on, you know, take your questions in reverse order. On your hypothetical, suppose they got the law, and I suppose there's a further factor, your hypothetical, right? Suppose the executive isn't enforcing it. Could they then come in and sort of force that?
That's what we have today, according to Massachusetts.
I understand. I think that gets into the merits of the case. I mean, my view is that Congress didn't write this, you know, the relevant provisions of the statute, you know, back in 1970. You know, to deal with this problem at all. This is a problem that, you know, is a very different kind of problem for which, you know, something like the NAAQS kind of solution isn't appropriate.
We're talking about standing here. Why shouldn't we have standing to present that issue to the court?
I understand your question. I think, again, if your hypothetical occurred, I would, like Justice Kennedy, essentially, you know, I want to see what that statute looks like. I think, and also like Justice Scalia would want to see what that statute looks like as well, before you could pronounce that there wasn't standing. That's not, it seems to me, the record in which this has been presented. There are serious questions as to whether EPA possesses this authority. And, you know, in terms of your protestation that, you know, you'd be happy essentially to have Massachusetts go to the halls of Congress, I mean, the real record here, as I think everyone knows, is that you know, there's a graveyard of failed legislative proposals to adopt you know, some form of climate change regulation. So this is not a, you know, democratic reinforcing process. This is a democratic end run around all of those failed proposals.
Massachusetts' position is they have gone to Congress, and they have a statute that requires regulation of carbon dioxide. That's their position.
I understand their position. My point would be this, and this ties in the standing issue to the merits issue again, is there is not authority under that statute. It's very vague, and if Congress in the 1990 amendments essentially repeatedly says, whenever it talks specifically about CO2, that the programs are to be taken to be non-regulatory in nature, it would be nonsensical for Congress in 1990 to take such care and to be a great pain to say that it's to be a non-regulatory program if there were authority under Section 202A. It just doesn't make any sense. It's not holistic statutory interpretation.
It sounds like you're suggesting that the court address the merits, and if they agree with Massachusetts, then find standing. Because if Massachusetts is right on the merits, then of course they would be able to.
Let me just step in here and if I may, reformulate Tim's question to maybe as a devil's advocate to Bill. And I think what we're grappling with is the fact that we all agree that redressability is going to be the key issue, certainly for the swing justices, maybe for the whole court. Where do you go in looking for the scope of the inquiry as far as redressability is concerned? Do you go to the structure of the statute, Bill, or do you go to the court's more common law / separation of powers theory of the judicial power in looking for, you know, how you're scoping your inquiry as far as redressability?
My sense is that there are five justices who, based on the argument and previous cases, you know, looking at Justice Kennedy, that I think they will look at it and saying, what is the action they're seeking from EPA? And so I don't think that in the end redress will turn on the idea that you have to have, you know, a scientist who can establish the exact way in which these, you know, the one ball will lead to another and you'll have certain types of harms. But so that's my guess. I also think that clearly you have three or four justices who will go the other way on it. I think that in Jeff we have the closest thing to a Justice Scalia, Justice Alito, adherent. I mean, you were very good at articulating their arguments, frankly, in a few places better. I'm glad you're not in the court. But the but also, I'd say just kind of two things. One is I want to say to Tim, you know, Justice Breyer asked that exact question and during the argument. He said, are you saying that to the Solicitor General's advocate, Mr. Garr, he said, if you're saying Congress passes a statute and they put the word CO2 right in it and they go sue, so if EPA doesn't do it, you're saying that Congress lacks the ability to make this actionable under Article 3. And he didn't answer. He said, well, Your Honor, we're saying two things, and then he didn't really answer directly. He was a good advocate there. It's a very tough question. But he did say, as Chief Justice Roberts picks up, well, Article 3 still stands. You know, so clearly for them, Article 3 still stands as a barrier. I also want to just pick up on one interesting thing I think that Jeff said, which I think is a more clear articulation of what some of the justices were getting at, which is an interesting argument. That is, you described the chain of just science, that is carbon dioxide to how it reacts in the environment to creating climate change, and then of course the way it manifests, chain of just science, that is carbon dioxide to how it reacts in the environment to creating climate change, and then of course the way it manifests harm as an indirect chain of causation, you said, to how it reacts in the environment to creating climate change, and then of course the way it manifests harm as an indirect chain of causation, you said twice a moment ago. And I find that very interesting because there's no other human agency in there once it's in the air. It really is, as you know, what Mielke said in his argument, referred to it as the laws of physics. I'm not sure I'd say physics, I'd probably say chemistry, I think you may have your finger on what they were trying to say is they see somehow the fact that we don't know exactly the way this is going to kind of meander its way through scientific chain reactions as somehow creating an indirect chain that would affect, I guess, both traceability as well as redressability. I find that to be very odd, and I don't see any precedent for that. If the court does that, I think that will also be a major change in standing law. If that is kind of the way something manifests itself through the science process, unmediated by human agency, if that creates a chain of causation problem, that's a change.
But Bill, isn't this the harder version of this question is the fact that you have some scientists who suggest that we might have already gone past the tipping point, and that 2.5% reductions aren't going to change hardly at all, least of all something that we can document as occurring in a particular place like Cape Cod. Isn't that the harder version of that question?
I'm not sure. I mean, my understanding is, again, this is an area where, I guess it's an artifact of the D.C. Circuit's strange affidavit rules, but from the science I've been reading on this, my understanding is no one expects it to be directly linear, and it's not necessarily exponential, but there does seem to be, it is some sense of cumulative effect. You know, the kinds of harms it's going to manifest is somewhat uncertain, but, I mean, you know, if you take the, you know, if we should look at market actors and how they behave, it's no coincidence that insurance companies are hiking up rates and refusing to insure all around the coast. I mean, it is, you know, you just, and I think in some sense Jeff's right, looking at the market tells you a lot, and I think you're saying market actors should be more privileged in the courts, which is clearly the view of Justice Scalia. But I think that in some sense there's indications that this is for real. So I guess, Jamie, go back to your question. I don't think the court should ever require a kind of certitude about that it will fix it completely, especially where the statute says, you know, contributions to pollutants. That should be the approach. I really do think there are probably five justices, but not having talked to Justice Kennedy, I don't know.
Can I just jump in and address one other aspect of one of Jeff's points, which I also think is interesting. In talking about what Congress has or has not already done, I think Jeff illustrated that you know, there's a legal question there that is very amenable to judicial resolution and to argument on both sides. And if you hypothesize that what EPA had done was granted the rulemaking petition and said, we do have authority to regulate under this statute greenhouse gases, and they then issued some regulation, Jeff and his clients would be in court challenging that. Their standing would be unquestioned. I agree with Jeff that it's far easier to demonstrate standing in that circumstance, and perhaps even that it should be. I'm not so sure about that. But as far as the question of separation of powers and whether these are suitable questions for courts to resolve in a democratic system, the question that his clients would be asking in that case is exactly this question. If it's an unsuitable question for courts to resolve, it should be unsuitable both ways. Now, I'm not saying that standing should always be the same both ways, because, you know, we're faced with the law as it is, and the law requires an injury in fact. And, you know, it is true that when you're directly regulated, you almost always have an injury in fact. And when you're asking for somebody else to be regulated, you have to show some injury, and that can be harder. But in terms of the nature of the intervention in our political system that's required in both cases, it's the same. And, you know, this also relates to the question of the American Horse Protection Association case. You know, it is true that the D.C. Circuit has said we have a low-key approach when the issue is failure to regulate, but the other aspect for that is that, you know, there are different reasons for failure to regulate. An agency says, we don't want to regulate, we've got better things to do, we have other priorities, we can't do everything, sorry. The D.C. Circuit is almost always going to uphold that. But if the agency says, I'm sorry, as a matter of law, we don't have authority to regulate here, that's just a straight legal question, and the American Horse Protection case says you can go in and petition for review of that issue. And I realize in this case there's some uncertainty over exactly how to interpret what EPA said, but at least one version, Massachusetts, is that kind of straight statutory, we don't have authority or we do have authority, is what's at issue here. And that, to me, seems like the essence of a justiciable question, and one that separation of powers in the really broad sense doesn't have a lot to say about whether the courts should or should not address. And in that circumstance, I think standing does unfortunately become a little bit of a game. It's being relied on to keep out a question that's perfectly suitable for judicial review if one advocate brings it, whereas if another advocate brings it, everybody would agree it could go forward.
Very quick response is that, you know, I think, Scott, that that depends on your theory, essentially, that, you know, there, what standing is about is kind of the nature of the question, whether there could be sufficient adversity as to the question. You know, I don't read the standing cases or the three-prong analysis to be focused on the question. I think the very first prong of the analysis is essentially whether there's injury in fact, which means that it depends on who the plaintiff is.
Fully.
Okay. So the thing is, okay. So we concede what the doctrine is, but I also think as a policy matter that makes perfect sense. While you can imagine here, and it's not necessarily an unrealistic hypothetical, that depending on the timing of when these questions arose, you could imagine a sort of 180 degrees opposite kind of challenge. That's not true all the time, and the point of having a standing doctrine that also depends on the notion of who the identity of the plaintiffs are is that it will sometimes, at the very least, even if, I would think it's more often than not, but Scott might disagree, that means that there is a coincidence between questions that aren't suitable for review and plaintiffs who aren't suitable to bring questions before the court. So, here, even if I were to grant that there was a complete disconnect between the two, as a doctrinal matter, it doesn't matter because the first prong of the analysis is what's the identity of the plaintiff and what can they demonstrate?
Question.
Yeah, I'm Glenn Sivanelli from Earth Justice, and just briefly, my interest in this goes back to at least back to when I was essentially board chairing for NWF, the Lujan versus Kamala Foundation case in the Supreme Court behind Brad Pruden and others. And most recently, we and a number of others have raised questions about Justice Roberts' nomination and opposed Justice Alito and others' Court of Appeals nominees, partly because of their positions on access to courts. But just a few quick points on instances that everybody brought up, and I particularly like Jeff to address these. But first of all, on the issue of imminence, I mean, I think it should be obvious, hopefully, that it's absolutely clear scientifically that if you ingest, if there's a poison out there that is not being prevented despite a congressional mandate, and the evidence is that will cause cancer in 50 years, then you should be able to stop it now. It doesn't matter that the injury won't occur until 50 years from now or something else like that. So the timing should not be an issue. If indeed the only time you can stop it is now, that should be good enough. And that's clearly what the argument is on global warming. Second point is, on the cumulative impact, clearly if 10 companies are poisoning the aquifer, one would think that you should have standing to challenge each one of them, even though you can't prove that if that one stopped, then the aquifer would be okay, because you have to bring the 10 separate challenges. And here, of course, there is a separate case pending, as was brought up in the oral argument, against power plants, and there could be other ones. So it isn't just the 2.5%. It's that once you get in the door, there are other things that could be regulated as well. And a third point is, in terms of the third-party actions, and this partly goes to the industry argument, I guess, is the special standing. Clearly, in the context, for example, of government bidders, you do have standing to argue that you were improperly excluded from bidding without showing at all what your chances would be if you were allowed to bid, that you're actually going to get the contract. It's a reduced likelihood of getting the contract, and regressibility and increased likelihood of getting the contract, even if that's fairly small. And that's standard law in a lot of areas that benefits industry. But here, when you're talking about people's lives, and in the case of Massachusetts, literally flooding the land that they own, and this is under a situation where what is happening is, as was pointed out by Bill and Tim, is the certainly the allegations are that this is a question of enforcing the law. We're not talking about making new policy. We're talking about a law which is the very last question the Supreme Court pointed out. For example, the law includes definition of public welfare to include climate in those terms. So that there certainly is at least a question whether this is there, and if you can't challenge it now, you have to wait till the dead bodies appear. You may be well past the tipping point, in which case you can't do anything about it at that point. So the point that Kennedy raised about maybe a small risk, but an enormous injury which could be irreversible once it goes past that tipping point, I don't see why that should not at least be allowed into court. You can argue the merits of what the statute says, but the idea that you're going to vote the bums out, well, 4 years may be too late. We could be all dead 30 years in the future from a variety of government actions, or in this case, we could have irreversible flooding and other impacts that couldn't be stopped despite the fact that you can theoretically vote the administration out, particularly in a case where you already have a statute which at least allegedly addresses the issue specifically.
Can you, panelists generally...
That's a Justice Breyer question. Then, what do you think about that, counsel? Right.
Well, I would say, first, let me make clear what I agree with you about. I think your cancer chemical hypothetical makes perfect sense, especially since I understand your hypothetical to mean that you're talking about a latent injury, right? Sort of there's some ingestion or exposure to the chemical, and then the cancer develops,
or
you know, some...
It will be released in 50 years in the case of, you know, something that... You buried it, it's going to collapse in 50 years, and whoever lives nearby is going to die.
Yeah, okay, those kinds of situations, too. But it seems to me that the global warming situation is different than that. And in terms of what was argued in the brief to the D.C. Circuit, the key point was redressability. It wasn't injury in fact or causation. And I think your most powerful arguments go to the first two prongs. And so putting aside whether I agree with you or disagree with you, I still think that the record here is insufficient on redressability issues. Redressability is key. And so I take the kinds of questions you're referring to that Justice Kennedy threw out as being questions that go to those prongs, but not quite. Actually, I can't think, and I was there at the argument of any questions that Justice Kennedy asked that went to the redressability issue, and I think there that the record is very weak.
And one last point, which is that you have no authority. I mean, all the analysis that I've seen of the argument agree on both sides of the issue, that all nine justices appear to agree that there is authority. So to the extent that you're relying on that, is there anything in the oral argument that gives you belief that will be the positions of five justices, if there's no authority here?
Well, I'm not making any predictions about how the case is going to come out. But in terms of the authority question, no, there were clear indications that a number of the justices were interested in the authority point. Justice Scalia was. Justice Scalia asked in particular about what I'll call the ambient air point. There's a release here into the ambient air, but the harm isn't caused by the release into the ambient air, and that's the sense in which this isn't a pollutant in the classic sense. It's not something where you release it, it's a poison. It's this indirect causal chain that results in the relevant harm. Now, in the argument, it seemed as if Justice Scalia had pause when he was told, well, what about sulfur dioxide? There, I think that, you know, the better answer, and I'll try to give it here, is that, you know, sulfur dioxide was not regulated for acid rain purposes in the NAAQS program. A new program needed to be created, Title IV. Similarly here, in order to regulate CO2 in its sort of global or wide area dimension, it seems to me that a separate program is required from Congress. EPA said as much, and the briefs in the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court said as much as well.
Jeff, it was regulated as a National Ambient Air Quality Standard pollutant prior to 1990, though.
Yes, no, I concede that. My point is that it's regulated for purposes of its sort of, you know, effects.
Other effects.
Right, it's not regulated for purposes of its acid rain effects. That required an entirely new title.
Well, maybe I can sort of extend the question to the other panelists then. In looking at redressability and how this court is likely to look at redressability in Massachusetts versus EPA, is it even legitimate, as Leslie reminds us, for them to look at other parts of the statute where a holding that EPA ought to take this first step could then prompt EPA to take the second, third, and fourth step under other parts of the same statute, under other parts of Congress's handiwork? Is it legitimate even for the court to look at that at this stage?
I guess my view is that they shouldn't. My view here is that this needs to be measured there. I mean, I just think that would be kind of problematic, as if people are bringing a suit and they're claiming that this is it. You look at the injury, you look at the traceability, you look at redress. It really is tied, you know, even for those who would more readily deny standing. I think in some sense it has to be tied into the particular program and the particular provisions that are at issue. I just think, but my sense here is it is being used opportunistically, maybe on both sides, to try to say bigger bang for the buck. Some people are saying, another for people who want to get standing and people who want to defeat standing are saying, but look at all these other people who are getting, you know, kind of the people are selectively bringing in the outside world and other aspects of the process.
The only thing I'd say about that is if there were actually a tight legal argument that the ruling here would require action in the other areas, you know, then clearly it would seem to me that any required action would count toward the redressability analysis. But other than that, if you have to challenge it as a discrete action, and after all, these people, you know, wouldn't have been permitted to come into court and say, you know, we're challenging the EPA's entire program with respect to global warming. But if as a result of that you're required to challenge discrete actions, I think you probably are going to be limited to, in some sense, the redress that you'll get from challenging those discrete actions. But I would also, you know, hope that by forcing people to sort of slice and dice their challenges that way, you don't require them to show then redressability in the sense that they'd have to show that that the whole problem has to be solved by steps that that would alleviate part of the problem.
Well, I'd like to thank our panelists very much. It's been a very lively discussion, and thank everyone for being here. But